really deeply appreciate having the hundreds of you join us for this weekly installment of Disappear Conversations. As you know, we took a little bit of a brief hiatus last week, in part because of the fireside chat that we organized with 92NY, as between Brett Stevens, our editor-in-chief, and Margaret Hoover from PBS's Firing Line. So if you didn't have a chance to join in person or virtually, it should be available to watch on the 92NY website in due time, maybe a week or so. Encourage you to watch that engaging conversation. But we're back. We're back today. And we're grateful to all of you from the broader Sapir family who are with us for a timely conversation with two brilliant minds on what is the 46th day of the war between Israel and Hamas. Now, the massacre of October 7th was undeniably a seismic event, certainly in Israel, but in the Middle East as well. And in the immediate aftermath, specifically the first few days after the attacks, you know, there are policymakers and pundits and journalists and everyday regular Joes. We all search for language to make sense of the moment. You know, often they or we would resort to the endless number of historical comparisons from our traumatic past. Within a few days, everyone, and I mean everyone, myself included, called it the deadliest attack in a single day since the Holocaust, 10 days after the attack, the analyst Chaviv Rett at Gore compared 10-7 to, quote, 25 Kishinev pogroms, right, referring to the Russian attack in 1903 that took the lives of 49 people and destroyed 1,500 homes and really changed the paradigm for Jews and their conceptions of Zionism. Others compared it to Kristallnacht. Many look to events like that were not specifically Jewish in nature, like 9-11. Some compared it to ISIS or modern day Nazis. And some, you know, as we discussed actually in our last conversation with Rabbi David Wolpe and Dr. Michal Biton, some resorted to references related to Amalek, right? The biblical enemy of the Israelites. Now, I completely understand the inclination to resort to history or to the memory of our ancestors to place our moment in the proper context. But here's what stood out to me, and maybe I'm overthinking this. All of these contextual comparisons were made to events that happened outside of Israel. No one, at least in English-speaking circles or outlets, compared it to events that took place in Israel or to Israelis. Why? Why was there no reference to, again, English-speaking outlets to the high school students who were taken hostage in Ma'alot in 1974, or the plane full of Israelis and non-Israelis who were taken hostage in Entebbe in 1973, or the Olympic athletes who were taken hostage in Munich in 1972. Many of us instinctively resorted to painful events that befell the Jewish people outside the land of Israel, not within it. Why? Yossi Klein Halevi put it powerfully and painfully in a number of podcasts in the weeks after. Yes, Jews have been killed before in Israel, of course, during its wars and its intifadas. But this was the first time that they were killed with their hands tied behind their backs. That intimate level of violence is something that befell Jews before the land of Israel, not in it. And it's in part what Israel and perhaps the Zionist project was created to prevent. Never to allow something like a pogrom to happen again, certainly not within the land of Israel. So, what is the impact of the October 7th attacks on Zionism? The impact of the attacks on the Zionist project, the Zionist experiment, on Israelis' conception of Zionism, on American Jewish perceptions of it. Well, we are honored to have two distinguished scholars, writers, thinkers, speakers, join us today to help us make sense of this moment and answer some of these questions. Their bios are long, so I'm going to keep this short, but encourage you to look them up and read their profound writings. Dr. Einat Wolf was a member of Knesset on behalf of the Labor Party from 2010 to 2013. Her most recent two books are the co-authored The War of Return, How Western Indulgence of the Palestinian Dream Has Obstructed the Path to Peace, published in 2020. And more recently, in 2022, We Should All Be Zionists, Essays on the Jewish State and the Path to Peace. Dr. Michael Koplow is the Chief Policy Officer of the Israel Policy Forum and also serves as a Senior Research Fellow of the Kagod Research Center at the Shlomo Hartman Institute of North America. Before coming to IPF, he was the founding program director of the Israel Institute. He writes Israel Policy Forum's weekly Koplow column. Love the alliteration and love the content even more. Encourage everyone to read it. Though no fault of their own, both are alumni of Harvard. They are each also alumni either as a professor or a student to their credit at Georgetown University. So with that, welcome Einat and welcome Michael.
Thank you.
If you're new to Sup Here, we welcome you with open arms. So glad you are here. If this is not your first Sup Here conversation, we are thrilled that you are back and encourage you to return again. And for everyone, a reminder, this is not just a conversation between the three of us with our two esteemed guests. It is also a discussion with you, which is why we invite you to pose questions throughout the conversation, which I'll ask in the final 15 or so minutes of the panelists. But again, we really want to make sure that you are able to ask your questions, and we'll try to get to a handful of them. All right, Dr. Wolf, if I may, let's start with you. Your gut reaction to that point at the very beginning, how did October 7th impact conceptions of Zionism within Israel at this point, or not at all?
So like many things, in two opposing directions. One that you alluded to in the things that Yossi Klein Halevi said is really the sense of the complete collapse. As I think the millennials like to say, you had one job, right? And if the state of Israel cannot defend its own citizens on its sovereign territory, if people are butchered and incinerated in their own homes, then what good are we? And that is a question that, as much as we'd like to avoid, it's staring us in the face, and it's a powerful question. And I think it's a gut reaction of many people, not just how could it happen? You could answer that in a lot of technical and intelligence failure, but if that happens, then what does it mean? So there's no question that there is a deep questioning that something like that leads to. But you also have the other response, which is a sense of resolve and resolution to build better and stronger. So you talked about comparisons within Israel. So within Israel, we also have the broader comparisons to 9/11 and ISIS and the pogroms and the pre-state years in the land of Israel, where the butchery already existed then. So anyone who tries to claim that this has anything to do with Netanyahu, with Qatar, with Iran, with Hamas, with the conditions in Gaza, we have such a long history of truly like awful butchery in the book of the War of Return. We even talk about how this was not new, that the butchery of the Jews during the War of Independence was photographed, and those photographs were highly coveted pieces that were traded and sold in the old city of Jerusalem. So even the idea of picturing or filming that is not new. So this is a long pattern that anyone who tries to pinpoint it on something recent would be, I think, would be blind to the century-long pattern. So we've compared it to all that and to the Yom Kippur War, but certainly one of the major comparisons was to Israel's War of Independence, because you did have then that what you call intimate level of butchery. And again, we can't make it that special. The fact that you had suicide bombers go into cafes, into pizzerias, into buses, into hotels on a Passover Seder, that was very much close up. What happened in various hijackings, what happened in the North, what happened with, we can't make it as if we're surprised that Palestinian terrorists are capable of this level of intimate face-to-face butchery. It's actually quite a specialty. So we shouldn't make it as if this is something completely new. But there is a sense of Israel's war of independence in the comparison, not just in terms of how brutal it is, but in terms of an understanding that Israel will have to be remade. And already we had a year that you could argue was a year of bubbling up of all the fundamental questions of what Israel is and what governs and who governs Israel and how to govern Israel. So a lot of Israel's fundamental issues were already at the surface in this past year. And there is definitely, I think, a certain resolve and understanding now that we will need to rebuild, recreate Israel as if this is a second war of independence.
Right. I was going to ask you about, I think, that language with Prime Minister Netanyahu or some other politicians have utilized, that this is, in fact, a second war of independence for the Jewish state, for
Israel.
Yeah,
he's just the wrong messenger for that message, but yeah, the message.
You might be the right one, though, for it.
Okay.
And others like you. Michael, just to you, I want to not point it out that, listen, this is not the first time. Obviously, difficult things have befallen Israel throughout its history at different points, including, for example, in 67, which ended up working in its Israel's favor. It had a profound impact on Americans' conception of the Zionist ethos. And, you know, I've long thought that people who are younger than 60, so to speak, have never experienced an Israel sort of at the existential brink. And if they did, what would that mean for their relationship with that country, for their understanding of the Zionist project? I'm going to continue to use that turn of phrase. This October 7th may or may not have been the closest thing to that. Existential might be too strong of a word, but in your understanding of sort of dynamics here in the United States, what have you seen in the last 6-7 weeks regarding the American Jewish relationship with Zionism?
You know, I brought up the Second Intifada, and I think it's an important comparison and a good one. And I've been using it since October 7th and speaking to different groups to illustrate the Israeli mindset and how Israelis will react. Over the course of about 5 years during the Second Intifada, you had about 1,100 Israelis who were killed, and the Second Intifada really transformed, I think, Israeli politics, Israeli society, the Israeli mindset. That many people were killed in one day, and anyone who doesn't think that Israel is going to have a very difficult time absorbing that and moving beyond it, I think, you know, doesn't understand the magnitude. And I think the same goes here in the U.S. I was in Israel last week, so I was not at the rally on Tuesday in D.C. But it, you know, all estimates are that there were just almost 300,000 people there. I think the last time there was a pro-Israel rally that got numbers anything approaching that was in April 2002, in the midst of the Second Intifada, and I was at that one. And that rally had about 100,000 people. And I think that when we talk about the way in which this impacts Zionism in the United States, there are basically two groups, and I think what happened reinforces their notions. You have a much larger group of American Jews who are Zionist and proudly pro-Israel and concerned about Israel's security, and they came out during the Second Intifada because that was a time during which Israel seemed as if it was under threat. And of course, they came out last Tuesday because this time Israel has undergone an even larger trauma, and I think in some ways a bigger threat. And this group of Americans, and it's most American Jews, has their Zionism reinforced by what happened, because it activates their concerns for Israel, their concerns for the safety of the Jewish state, their concerns for the security of their Israeli relatives and friends and colleagues. And it also reinforces, in some ways, maybe counterintuitively given what happened, reinforces the sense that Jews are not safe anywhere. This is the original reason for political Zionism back in the 19th century. And so we have to have a Jewish state. And the fact that this atrocity took place in the Jewish state, I don't think leads most American Jews to say, well, now we aren't safe anywhere. I think the reaction is to say, we need to make sure that Israel is even stronger and that Israelis are more secure, because people are going to want to get us no matter where we are, even inside of the place that is supposed to be the ultimate safeguard of Jewish safety and security. So I think for the vast majority of American Jews, what happens activates all of these things that lead American Jews to be overwhelmingly Zionist and reinforces those feelings. You then have a smaller group who in many ways have been just as vocal as the majority of American Jews, who are either non-Zionist or anti-Zionist. And most of that, well, I'll say it stems from two things. I'll say, you know, I think first it stems from a conviction that Israel is not fulfilling their Jewish values as they see them. And that's mostly with regard to how Israel treats the Palestinians. And for that group, they look at this and they don't see a massacre of Israelis by Hamas terrorists. They see, very unfortunately in my view, a response from Palestinians that results from oppression, colonization, apartheid, whatever term you want to use. I should note, by the way, this is not my opinion. I don't agree with those things. But they view this as a response to that. And so I think it reinforces their anti-Zionism, because they say, look, all of these things that we have been warning against and all of these things that we find to be repellent to our Jewish values causes something like this and will continue to do so. And how can we support a state that has oppressed Palestinians and that now in response to October 7th is going to kill more Palestinians? And so I think for that group, this makes their anti-Zionism come out even more so. I think there's also a more subconscious element to the group of anti-Zionist Jews. And this has to do with the fact that we here in the United States are living, or I should say at least up until a few years ago, we're living in the absolute golden age of the Jewish diaspora across history. We've had this unbelievable 5, 6, 7 decade run, after World War II, maybe started a little later, up until now, where Jews live in the United States, not entirely, but largely free from state anti-Semitism, institutionalized anti-Semitism, overt discrimination. We are free, we are prosperous, we are overrepresented at kind of the highest levels of everything. And for people who don't necessarily then see the need for a Jewish state to secure their safety and their freedom, I think it's easier to discount the importance and necessity of Zionism. Because if you think that we've somehow here in the United States escaped Jewish history, and I don't think that we have, but if you think that we have, and that somehow centuries and millennia of Jewish persecution have been ended here in the United States, then you can look at Israel and think of it as a luxury. And if you don't agree with everything it's doing, you can much more easily be opposed to it. And I think that, you know, that plays into all of this as well. And in my opinion, things in the United States are, you know, not just since October 7th, but before that, are taking a bit of a worrisome turn. And I think that that is going to put a bit more pressure over time on the anti-Zionist group of American Jews as it becomes more obvious to more people that perhaps we aren't quite as safe and secure and comfortable in the United States as we thought and always assumed. But until that happens, I think that October 7th really does play to the fundamental instincts of both of these groups and reinforces either their Zionism and the need for it, or on the other side, reinforces another group's anti-Zionism and reinforces their sense that they are the ones who are in the camp of justice.
Very interesting. So basically, radical acts lead to basically a radicalizing of positions to a certain extent, or a strengthening of certain positions. It forces those who, let's say, in the anti-Zionist camp to dig in to their anti-Zionism and say, look, Israel is causing actually more deaths of Jews and Palestinians, causing people who have an inclination or a connection to Israel and are passionate Zionists to say, wait a second, now more than ever before, we actually need this country, because there has to be a safe haven at a time of an uptick of anti-Semitism. Up until October 7th, Einat, there was a disconnect within Israel between those in the Jewish Israelis, let's say, and there is a growing disconnect, one could argue, between Israeli Jews or American Jews and the Israeli government. To what extent do you think October 7th actually patched over those dynamics, or served as like a way to contend with that undeniable reality?
So I think what's common now to more and more American Jews and Israelis, Jews and non-Jews, is that we're ignoring our government, or we're trying really, really hard to ignore our government, because it's essentially, it's between terrible and non-existent, but there has actually been nothing positive that I can think that this government did since October 7th. In a different world, you could imagine a country being hard hit, but then its leaders rising to the occasion. But what happened in Israel is the country was hard hit, the leaders were AWOL, and the people rose to the occasion. So you've heard it by now before. This is not new. It's everywhere, from the news to individual stories. There is a great sense that really we are all witnessing how remarkable Israel and Israeli society is. Jews, Arabs, Druze, I mean, the sense of mobilization across numerous sectors. It's not only the military mobilization. It really is across numerous sectors. And the sense of many citizens towards the government is either they're non-existent, or please don't interfere because you're only ruining things, whether it is our efforts at telling the story of Israel, I mean, anything on that level. And I think also American Jews are seeing it, that the people of Israel are increasingly disconnected, and certainly far better than their leaders. I don't think we have ever had a moment, I think, in Israel where it was so apparent that we are being led by our lessers, if you can say that. Between really corrupt mediocrities and cowards, that's generally the kind of the range of what we have. And I think, as part of what I said before about the notion that we need to build stronger and better, there is a growing realization among many elites in Israel that they will have to go back into politics and go into public service, and that by leaving the political sphere to people of lower quality, we were actually endangering the entire project. I have a colleague who said beautifully, he said, one of the main reasons we got to October 7th is that more and more people got comfortable living on the interest. And I think that's true also of American Jews. You alluded to it, the sense that everyone got comfortable. And I think we in Israel got comfortable, and many Jews around the world got comfortable. And we just forgot what it took to build the capital. And we were just living off the interest, forgetting how much sacrifice and effort went into the capital. We forgot that when we needed to tell our story to the world, we had a Herzl and a Weizmann and an Abba Ibn. And then we started sending mediocrities to tell our story, because you can, you know, ambassadorial positions are things you hand out in order to solve political problems. because it doesn't really matter who represents Israel and who tells their story. Or you can just gut the civil service because, you know, you need to give jobs to people and it doesn't matter who does job, who does what. Or you can have a government where you have representation, substantial representation by people who, as a matter of principle, refuse to defend the state they're living in and want to only receive from the budget rather than ever contribute to it. And the notion that you can have a country where people just take and not give, that cannot hold. So I think there is a sense by now that, and we're seeing it also in the polls, but that the gap between the people and the government is just too vast and cannot hold for much longer.
Panan, if I can build on this point that Inat just made about the gap between the people and the government. That's very obviously the case in Israel, but I think this is a spot where at least I see a bit of a divide between Israelis and between American Jews, because American Jews spent the 10 months of this government before October 7th starting to come around to the idea that perhaps the government of Israel was not doing Israel any favors. And you saw criticism coming from quarters of American Jewry, both individuals and institutions, that really nobody had seen before. And there was the sense that it was now okay to criticize the Israeli government in a way that perhaps previously would have been considered treif. And the reaction of American Jews to October 7th has been this overwhelming sense of solidarity. And at least what I've seen is that while Israelis absolutely separate between, for instance, the government and the IDF, you know, you look at polls where 4 out of 5 Israelis approve of the IDF's response and 4 out of 5 Israelis disapprove of the government's response. And you see the polls that has Benny Gantz getting more seats on his own than the 5 parties that make up the old coalition together. Whereas in the United States, I think a lot of people now have gone back to this reluctance to criticize the Israeli government because they say, hey, you know, it's wartime. We shouldn't be criticizing anything that Israel is doing. And American Jews have been celebrating, perhaps more than anything, the idea that Israel before went through this period of 10 months of unprecedented societal fracture. And that now, you know, Biachad Ninatzeach, right? We're all gonna win together. And there's this notion that Israel is unified as it never was. And, you know, I'll say from my own perspective, you know, I've given literally hundreds of just horribly depressing talks and interviews over the past 6 weeks. And so many times I'm asked, is there any silver lining? And one of the things I say is that Israeli society was very fractured and looked like it was coming apart, and now everybody's working toward a common goal. But it's also very clear to me, having just spent a week in Israel, that there is an enormous amount of ferment under the surface, that the second the fighting is over, there are going to be hundreds of thousands of Israelis in the streets every single day, not just on Saturday nights, protesting the government until it leaves. You're going to have many extremely angry reservists who will literally camp out outside the Knesset. And I don't think that this government is going to leave quite so easily. And I think that it's going to come as something of a shock to American Jews who think that Israel now is completely unified and moving in one direction. And I think that's true so long as the fighting takes place. But I think many American Jews expect that this will last. And not only do I not think it will last, I am deeply worried that the societal fractures inside of Israel are actually going to be even worse than they were before, given just how unpopular this government is, and given just how hard I think this government is going to hang on to try and stay where it is. And I think that American Jews are not prepared for that, and we should be.
Your reaction to that?
I can't refute that I have that fear as well. I mean, there's no question, I don't know about the government as a whole, but there's no question that certainly Netanyahu, and he's known for that. I mean, he's when his back is against the wall, he fights the hardest. So I doubt that he will I mean, it's not that I doubt. He will not go quietly into the sunset. But I do think that there is a profound realization, even if people do not say it in those words, is that Israel cannot be trusted with a pure right-wing government. A few weeks ago, before October 7th, I attended a conference in Britain, and there was a panel on politics that I listened in onto. And someone in that panel said that the Tory party is the natural ruling party of Britain. And I wasn't aware of that. And they said, look, in the last 120 years, 90 years, Britain was ruled by Tories and 30 years by Labour. And typically when Labour moved to the center, as with Tony Blair. So I thought about it in the Israeli and Zionist context. And I thought, okay, in the Israeli context, it's clear that the Labour Party, Mapai, is Israel's natural ruling party. And if you think about it, even after Mapai was officially out of power, Labour was out of power in 77, there was no government except two, Begin in 81, and this government, when there was no what I call the Mapainik babysitter, the Labour babysitter. The Labour being the people who actually knew what it took to build this country, could never trust anyone else to run this country. So it led also to a lot of bizarre political behaviors, but the fundamental kind of trigger was we can't trust anyone to run this very fragile project. And you can see that to the present day, the Likud, having been a party of opposition, is also a party that even when they're in power, they behave as if they're in the opposition. They never take responsibility. It's always someone else's fault, and it always goes back to Mapai. Now, Israel had a pure right-wing government only twice, in 81 with Begin and this government. And by now, it can't be a coincidence that those are two governments that brought Israel to the brink with the Lebanon War, with the insane inflation, everything that you needed Labour to actually come in to stop, and now this government. And we are yet also to see the economic implications of what will happen. So the reason that you're seeing, in a way, a bizarre behavior by Israelis, on the one hand, there is a more hawkishness, you could say. I wouldn't call it right wing, but an understanding that also formed during the Second Intifada, but now is even stronger, that Palestinians are dead serious when they say from the river to the sea. They actually mean it. So you could say that Israelis are much more hawkish in understanding what our enemies want. And this, again, reverts back to historic Labour, Mapai. You know, Mapai or Labour are called left. When they were in power, they were never left-wingers. I mean, not some hippy-dippy peaceniks. You know, they knew precisely who Israel's enemies were and what they wanted. But you're seeing so many of the votes go to Gantz, go to other parties, because they're basically saying, we can't trust the right. However hawkish we are, we can't actually trust the right to govern this country. So one analysis I saw by a pollster is that the expectation that Israeli politics will revert to where Zionism was in the foundational years, he described it as a hawkish center, which is basically Mapai. Ben-Gurion said, we'll govern without Chirut and Maki, without the right wing and without the communists. This notion of a hawkish center might definitely return. It's also, of course, my wish. It's where I find myself politically. But I can't refute the possibility that people will be at each other's throat. We see that as well. I prefer to think, and there's also good signs, that Israelis will actually revert to this hawkish center.
So I want to build on that and encourage everyone, if you haven't yet, or even if you have, please send questions, which we will get to in about a little under 10 minutes. Einat, you have written about this in books, in articles, in essays, and might have yourself sort of experienced it as well. The Intifada, the Second Intifada, it really had a pretty dramatic impact on the Labour Party, but the left as a whole. And I'm curious to what extent we'll see additional manifestations of this once the rally around the flag mentality of the war subsides. And what, I mean, at the risk of trying to prognosticate, what's your sense for what will be?
So the Israeli left, as it became in the, mostly in the 90s, and really it's really in the 90s, mostly just for 5 years or a decade. Because as I said, for most of the time, what we call today the Israeli left, the Israeli Labor Party, if you look at their speeches from the perspective of what we think of as left today, they would be way, way to the right. So again, very hawkish, no illusions about who our enemies are, what they want. So the left, in terms of the idea of land for peace, making peace with the Palestinians, negotiating, so kind of the 90s, and even in the 90s, if you look at Rabin's speech on the eve of his assassination, on what he thinks is the vision ultimately, Netanyahu's Bar-Ilan speech was to the left of that. A lot of people are disoriented by this idea. So we really only have a few years of an Israeli left in the sense of Ehud Barak going to Camp David, negotiating with the Palestinians, giving them the proposal, a state in the West Bank and Gaza, capital in East Jerusalem, the whole nine yards. But when the Palestinians, when Arafat walks away from this proposal, and this is after certainly people like myself have been told for about a decade at this point, maybe 15 years, that what the Palestinians want is to end the occupation. They're angered by the settlements. They want a capital in East Jerusalem. To see with my own eyes a Palestinian leader walk away from that and follow it up by a campaign, again, of brutal massacres, basically led a lot of Israelis to question what do Palestinians want and to realize. I ultimately wrote a whole book about it, but I think most Israelis realized viscerally that when Palestinians say from the river to the sea, they're very serious. And if you're going to offer them a state in the West Bank and Gaza, but you're still going to insist that the Jewish state remains in the other part of the territory, the Palestinians are going to walk away. And they walked away again in 2008. Because more than they care about having a state for themselves in this territory, they care more about the Jews not having their state. So this, of course, led to the complete collapse of the left in the sense of the peace left. I mean, what are you going to offer people? Let's negotiate with the Palestinians, but nothing's ever going to come out of it because they want us gone. I mean, that's not a compelling political message. Land for peace was a compelling political message. Give them what they want and they'll leave us alone and we'll have peace was a compelling message. Let's negotiate and they want all of it, so nothing will ever come out of negotiations, is not a compelling political message. And that's why you have decades or years by which the left tries to go to social issues, religion and state issues. But the number of certainly Israeli Jewish members of Knesset who think that the reason we don't have peace is because Israel didn't offer enough or that Israel didn't try hard enough, maybe one, maybe two. So I don't see how we can collapse more than that. In parallel, I would also argue that the right collapsed because the vision of greater Israel and the settlements, I mean, despite what we hear, doesn't have the support of the vast majority of Israelis. So I think what we'll see is really a reversion to the only ideology that was ever able to govern and sustain Israel. And that again is Mapai, the hawkish center. That's the only thing that ever worked.
Michael, you've spent a career, kind of like Anna, I spent a career writing about this and serving in a political capacity. You've spent a career advocating for a two-state solution. That the central component of the two-state solution is that Israel has to remain both a Jewish and democratic state. And that should be at the heart, sort of the Zionist conceit in this moment. Again, we're 6-7 weeks in, military operations are still undergoing. What's your sense in having just returned from Israel about whether how people on the left in particular, we kind of know where the right is, how's the left in particular thinking about the notion of a two-state solution? What did you see? What did you hear?
I don't think almost nobody is talking about in Israel, at least, talking about two states. In the wake of something like October 7th, as Einat correctly points out, I don't think you're going to find people who in Israel who say, well, the lesson is that we should try to give the Palestinians more, or if only we had tried harder. But to my mind, the fundamental necessity of an eventual two-state outcome has not gone away, precisely because if we want to keep Israel Jewish, democratic, and secure, I don't see another way of doing it. And I do think that there is an opportunity here not to restart a peace process, not to move toward a two-state, a final stage of a two-state outcome, which is decades away, if we're lucky. I think that the opportunity is to get Israelis to realize that some of the things that have made two states much more difficult now do need to be rolled back. And, here again, Einat's example of hawkish centrism as represented by Mapai and Labor, I think, is instructive. People love to point out that Labor governments were the first ones who put settlers inside the West Bank. But that was the Alon plan. The Alon plan was carried out for security purposes. It was not an ideological plan. It put people in two spots. One was the Jerusalem Triangle, that basically it's a triangle from Modi'in Elite in the northwest to Maal Adumim just east of Jerusalem, down to Beitar Elite southwest of Jerusalem, so that you could widen the approach to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, widen that corridor, which at the narrowest point, I think was 4 miles wide, to provide security. And that was successful because that Jerusalem Triangle is the only spot in the entire West Bank beyond the Green Line where you have a ratio of Jews to Palestinians that is 50-50. The other spot was in the Jordan Valley, which was also seen as necessary for security. It was the right-wing governments that then decided, hey, we need to put people on the mountain ridge. Hey, we need to put people as close to major Palestinian population centers as possible. Hey, we need to allow 210 illegal outposts across the West Bank to disrupt Palestinian contiguity, even though these are places where the ratio of Palestinians to Jews is 99-1, and where securing those people is almost impossible, which is why you had 70% of active duty IDF forces in the West Bank on October 6th, because when you put people far into the West Bank and you have to protect literally hundreds of very small communities, some of which have literally only a handful of people and some of which have just a few hundred people, you are stretching yourself very thin. And I think the opportunity here isn't to go to a peace process. It's to get Israelis to understand that 80% of the people living over the Green Line are living on 4% of the West Bank that is directly attached to the Green Line. And it's basically the Jerusalem Triangle and a few other places a little farther north in Karnei Shomron. And if Israel focuses on that and says, you know what, we're not going to unilaterally disengage, we're not going to hand anything back to the Palestinians without a permanent status agreement, but we're going to stop incentivizing people to go deep into the West Bank. We're going to stop allowing people to set up illegal outposts that every single time it happens requires IDF soldiers going there to protect them. We're going to stop the things that really harm Israeli security, and we're going to focus on what is best for all of Israelis in terms of security and not in terms of an ideological vision of Eretz Yisrael Hashleima. That to me will be one of the most important steps that can happen on the way to two states. And it doesn't have to be done by talking about two states. I think that this should be very common sense for most Israelis as a response to October 7th. If you need the IDF on the border with Gaza and if you need the IDF on the border with Lebanon, then you simply cannot have 70% of them in the West Bank protecting 150,000 people who are scattered all across the place. So I think that my belief in the necessity of two states has not waned at all. But I think that political realities are what they are. And you can do things that will appeal to most Israelis in this moment. And they will also, not coincidentally, move toward two states down the road. And these things do not depend on having somebody on the other side to negotiate with. And they don't depend on making concessions that Israelis right now are simply not in any mood to make.
I want to build on that with a question to you, Einat, stemming from Eric Lippman, who asks, would a move to a quote-unquote hawkish center include the continued building of settlements in the West Bank? That's a question.
So I completely agree with Michael. I think this is where most Israelis will begin to enter. Just the notion of, we have territory that we need to protect, and we're just going to ask the laser question of what, how can we most effectively protect Israel's citizens? That's back to the question of, you had one job. And I think the question will increasingly be over the settlements, not one of ideology or God or Bible, or not even what the Palestinians think. A lot of people try to tell me, you know, building settlements convinces the Palestinians will never go away, or removing settlements pacifies them because they have a future. And I had to tell both sides that, unfortunately, I don't know, but unfortunately, settlements as a factor in the Palestinian rejection of Zionism is zero. So whether we build them or whether we dismantle them, it has exactly zero impact on whether Palestinians are committed or not committed to From the River to the Sea. As I said, it's a century-long commitment. They never wavered from it. So we built, we didn't build, we dismantled. That had no impact on this aspect. So the only question we need to ask about settlements is a domestic one. Do they increase or decrease Israeli security? That's it. And I tend to fall more. I don't think it's such a clear-cut argument. You can have arguments on both sides, but I fall more, I would say, 70-80% to the fact that at the end of the day, they decrease much more Israeli security, precisely because of the things Michael mentioned. They stretch the IDF thin. They put the IDF in a position of doing work that is not about defense of the territory of the state of Israel and its citizens. It changes the nature, the ability of the IDF to prepare, to train for its singular mission of defending Israel. So I think that Israel kind of having a more coherent, clear territory, the military will stay in the West Bank, and it might also probably stay in control of the Gaza Strip, whoever rules it, but Israel will retain military control until we have, and I have to say, I actually do speak about two states and peace. But I speak about it, I call myself these days a long-term peace activist, because I say if we're ever to achieve peace, and this has always been the Zionist goal, one of acceptance in the region, we need to understand that the Palestinians are truly committed to the ideology of From the River to the Sea. And we need to take active steps, something we never did for our entire existence, to change the Palestinian ideology. And I'm now working a lot studying what the Americans did in Japan after World War II. There's a lot of interesting parallels. I'm aware of the differences as well. But as a very powerful act that also included ultimately a very radical positive vision of changing the entire character of a nation, the entire commitment of a nation, to one that would allow it to become a pillar of the peaceful world, I believe that we need nothing less than that with the Palestinians. The tragedy of the Palestinians, and therefore our tragedy over the decades, has been that they have been a receptacle, a willing one, of every failed ideology for the last century. From Nazism, once you see the Nazi impact on Palestinians, on the Arab world, you can't unsee it, to pan-Arabism, to communism, to Sunni and then Shi'i jihadism, to currently left-wing extremism. every failed ideology in the last century latched into the willing Palestinians because it needed the Palestinians as the people who fight the Jews. Because failed ideologies, in parentheses, need Jews as their very effective scapegoat. So we need to finally disconnect Palestinians from ideologies of failure. And we'll need to mobilize the West and to mobilize the East and to mobilize the successful Arab world, those countries that are letting go of anti-Zionism as a feature of Arab identity, in order to transform the Palestinian ethos away from a singular commitment to there not being a Jewish state into one that finally allows them to say, we want to live next to the Jewish state of Israel rather than instead of it.
Yeah, on that score, I want to actually, that's a tall order, certainly, to sort of impose or encourage a different movement to conceptualize their priorities in a different way. But the question, I actually want to revert back. 67 had a profound impact on religious Zionism, right? I'm curious to what extent 2023 will have the inverse impact or not on religious Zionism. And building off of that, Anonymous asks, one aspect of change within Israeli society is the Haredi joining the war effort. Does this fact change the traditional view of Haredim towards the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, getting a pass on the draft, contributing to the tax base after the war comes to some sort of conclusion? So anyway, the Haredi dynamic here and the impact of religious Zionism 2023 onward. Maybe let's start with you, Einat, and Michael, your gut reaction. Just in a minute or so. So we have to feel.
I think religious Zionism emerges from this as a complete failure. I don't know, but again, could be part wishful thinking, could be, but I mean, they literally have nothing to show for them as governors of this country. And the Haredis, it's great that a lot of Haredis are volunteering and changing their attitude and even taking selfies of themselves doing military training. But at the end of the day, we need to remember that the entire way of life of the Haredi population in Israel is courtesy of the Zionist state. It doesn't exist in Antwerpen. It doesn't exist in Brooklyn. It only exists in Israel. And it only exists also like another thing that the disastrous Begin government of 81 gave us is the complete letting go of all guardrails, not just on settlements, but on also the Haredi issue, essentially making their way of life, which just takes from Israel, but gives nothing possible. And this is something that will have to end. We can't just sit patiently and wait for them to change from within. We have to make it clear that we're done, that the Zionist project, that the state of Israel cannot afford to have such a large population that refuses to defend the state and only takes and never gives. That will have to go.
Michael, a question from Anonymous. On the way to a distant future of two states, how can one influence the hate that continues to be generated by the Palestinian populace and promoted by UNRWA and the forever refugee status? End quote. Your reaction to that question?
So first, I want to say something to the previous question about religious Zionism. I think one of the things that was underappreciated about the last election, election number 5, when Smotrich and Ben-Gvir got a huge rise in support. And many people looked at it and said, well, it's a result of May 2021. You had riots in mixed cities. This is what Ben-Gvir was running against. All true. It's also the case that in election number 5, Naftali Bennett didn't run. And because Naftali Bennett did not run, you effectively, within the religious Zionist community, did not have what was viewed as a more moderate option. And so people voted for Smotrich and Ben-Gvir because they said, hey, we are religious Zionists. We are self-identified as Dati Lumi, and this is really the only Dati Lumi party running. And so what you got was this an enormously extremist party that now purports to speak in the name of all religious Zionism. In fact, calling themselves as a party, Hatzionut HaDati, religious Zionism. And what we've seen since October 7th is even more extremism coming from folks in the Smotrich Ben-Gvir camp in the West Bank, where they are effectively using the IDF distraction in Gaza to run rampant, rampage against Palestinians, throw them out of their villages. The level of violence from extremist settlers in the West Bank since October 7th is up, by some estimations, 700%. So I'm hopeful, and perhaps this is more hope than analysis, that many religious Zionists who do not identify with that will look at this in horror, that in the next election, either Naftali Bennett or somebody else will run in an effort to capture some of these voters, and that religious Zionism as a movement will come back toward a more moderate position versus what we have now, where I'm very comfortable saying that religious Zionism, certainly the party, but in many ways the movement, is doing more damage to Israel than almost any other force inside of Israel. In response to the question you actually asked, the Palestinians are going to do what the Palestinians do. I think that it's our job as Zionists and as American Jewish supporters of Israel, and you know, I'm sure Einat would say her job as an Israeli, to worry about the Israeli side and to do what we can to build back an Israeli politics and society that is equipped to handle the challenges that are coming from this side of the ocean, to support Israel in doing that and help Israel move toward a better place. So I don't have good answers for how you combat Palestinian hate, but I certainly have answers for how we should respond. And the way we should respond is by doing what we can to make Israel a better, stronger place for not only Jews, but everybody who lives there.
Can I say something on that, or is that okay?
Please, yeah.
So I actually think that we've been negligent in not fighting the Palestinian ideology, only occasionally going to war and trying to stop terrorism. And my work in recent years, and it has been very frustrating, was to alert Israeli decision makers and security officials to the Palestinian ideology, to say that unless we confront directly that this is an entire society and people committed to this, we are guaranteed endless wars and terrorism, because it doesn't matter if you call it Hamas or Jihad or the DFLP or Black September or Fatah or Fedayeen, as long as this is the ideology, you will always have a new generation of trained murderers ready to operate on behalf of that ideology. And I actually think that we need to be very harsh in demanding a change to that ideology. I'm already disheartened by how we're handling, for example, the trucks that are entering Gaza. Because if it were up to me, I would make it clear that we're happy to give those trucks, but they need to be given in exchange for a clear declaration. I would demand a declaration filmed, written, for any bag of rice, any liter of fuel that says, we are receiving this with the understanding that Gaza is Palestine. We are not refugees. We have no right of return into the state of Israel. We have no interest in liberating Palestine from the river to the sea. We only want to develop Gaza for its inhabitants. We want to live next to the Jewish state of Israel and not instead of it. And if they don't sign, then no rice and no fuel and no nothing. And from the book about Japan, if I may share, I was always opposed to doing anything with the books and UNRWA, because I always said, look, the teachers are Palestinians. They believe they're refugees. They believe in liberating Palestine from the river to the sea. You give them new books tomorrow, they won't teach those books. They'll still teach that Palestine was stolen and the noble duty of every child is to grow up and liberate Palestine from the river to the sea. But then I learned what the Americans did in Japan with the books, and that's inspired. The Japanese teachers and children, the students themselves, had to take their existing books, not new ones, and they had to, with a black marker, erase anything that spoke of the supremacy of the Japanese race, of imperial ambitions, of emperor worship, and they had to hold the pages against the sun. And if you could still read those words, you had to go again with a black marker. And again, not a lot was left from those books, But an entire generation of Japanese children remember this as a foundational experience that made it clear that the old ideology was defunct and they need to move forward. And I think we need a series of actions. I think no person should go back to northern Gaza unless they sign a declaration that says, again, they're not refugees, they have no right of return, they don't want to liberate Palestine from the river to the sea. No school should open in Gaza without going through this process in the books. I think we finally need to put an end. We can't just sit back and let it be the way we did for so many decades.
So much to unpack in that last piece. Unfortunately, we are at time. I will ask you, Einat, one last question. Someone asked anonymously if you're going to return to politics.
I'm seriously considering it because, like I said, to see the gap between the remarkable country we have and the people we have and the bunch of kind of clowns that are governing us is really too painful.
And Michael, no one asked if you're going to go into politics, but I am curious if you have one last word for this group, anything in particular stand out that you'd like to share with the crowd?
I would say don't despair. Obviously, what has happened over the past 6 weeks has been terrible, and there are going to be very difficult times ahead. But Israel remains strong. I think it remains the strongest state in the region. American Jews remain overwhelmingly Zionist and supportive. Obviously, we are going to have our own challenges here at home with anti-Semitism, and I think there's another webinar I'm sure to be had on that topic. But ultimately, we will get through this, and I'm very hopeful that both Israel and American Jews will come out the other side stronger.
Amen, amen, amen. I encourage everyone to read Michael's columns, to read Einat's writings, to continue to read the content coming out of Sapir Journal. You can check it out, sapirjournal.org, to sign up for our newsletter. And if there are different topics or ideas that you think we should include in these weekly discussions, please don't hesitate to reach out. We thank you deeply, Dr. Einat Wolf and Dr. Michael Koplow, and the hundreds of you who joined us today. Everyone be well, stay safe. Thanks again.